Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Hello and welcome to The Sidebar, presented by True Crime Daily, taking you inside the courtrooms of high-profile and notorious cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a criminal defense lawyer based here in Los Angeles and previously an LA County prosecutor for nearly a decade. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. We are recording this on Friday, December 15th, 2023. In this week's episode, trial is underway for a mother charged with the torturous murder of her own 15-year-old son, who died of hypothermia in an ice bath in a twisted form of punishment. Also, the murder conviction of a vigilante who shot an elderly man, she chased down after he allegedly fled the scene of a car accident. But first, the Adelson family drama continues. As the son receives a life sentence, his mother is arraigned for her role in the murder-for-hire plot that left a Florida law professor dead. Today, we are very happy to be joined by Michelle Yu, a Emmy Award-winning journalist, author, and legal commentator you can catch on Law & Crime, as well as many other media outlets. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Josh. Really excited.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this. Before we jump in, you have a bit of an interesting background as to how you ended up at Law & Crime now. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I basically have a journalism background, and I started in news as a local reporter here in New York City. But I always had aspirations of wanting to be a sportscaster, and I did that for 10 years. I worked for the home of the Mets. But, you know, my journalistic blood was still there, and Law & Crime kind of came about. And, you know, one of the job descriptions of Law & Crime was you had to be a lawyer. And I was very upfront. I'm like, I'm not a lawyer. And, you know, the president, Rachel Stockman, said, it's OK. You can treat this like a sports broadcast because you have great analysts like Josh who come on and they are your analysts, like you're analyzing a game. And we're treating court like it's a game. And, you know, when you see it in a different perspective, I kind of get it. I'm actually a true crime junkie. I read all this stuff all the time anyway. And now to put it into like a work platform, it's been great.
Oh, that's cool. I like that it is like a sport. I mean, you are watching two opposing sides trying to score points. I mean, not to make so light of it, but it's absolutely true. I think that's an excellent way of looking at it. And what I do love is they saw the goods and they said, you know what, we're going to drop that whole law requirement. Just go ahead and put her on. We need her. I love it. In any case, I'm really happy that you came on, because I know that you do follow these cases so closely and you always have a very interesting take that I appreciate. So let's go ahead and jump right in. First, we go to Tallahassee, Florida, where the Adelson family's ongoing legal saga begins its next chapter. Last week, Charlie Adelson was sentenced to life without parole within days of his mother's arraignment, as the Adelson matriarch pleads not guilty to her involvement in the murder-for-hire plot. The misadventures all arose when a custody battle between Wendy Adelson and her ex-husband Dan Markell ended when Markell shot to death in the driveway of his Tallahassee, Florida home. Prosecutors allege that Wendy's brother, Charlie Adelson, and mother, Donna Adelson, were involved in orchestrating the murder. Charlie Adelson was convicted last month for his role in planning the contract killing, utilizing his ex-girlfriend Catherine McBanois to hire the shooters who killed Markel. On December 12th of this year, Charlie was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Throughout the hearing, Charlie Adelson remained stoic, but when offered the opportunity to speak on his own behalf, Adelson made a point in maintaining his innocence. Meanwhile, the Adelson matriarch, Donna Adelson, was arrested shortly after his son's conviction while allegedly attempting to flee the country. The 73-year-old was subsequently jailed on charges of murder and conspiracy. Donna Adelson has denied her involvement in the crime, pleading not guilty in her arraignment earlier this week. Courtroom observers took notice of Adelson's demeanor in court when she seemed exasperated with the proceedings from the onset. The Adelson family members are the fourth and fifth alleged co-conspirators to face charges in the deadly plan. This came as no surprise to those who followed Charlie Adelson's trial, as wiretapped conversations between the mother and son were used heavily in his trial. Donna Adelson was allegedly so desperate to have her daughter and grandchild relocate closer to the family in South Florida that she was willing to cut her son-in-law out of the picture, even if it involved murder. I mean, just saying that is staggering to me. While she's scheduled to appear in court again in January of next year, her defense has alleged that the elderly woman has been subject to, quote, cruel and inhumane conditions while being held without bond ahead of her trial. According to her defense attorney, Donna was forced to sit naked on a mattress on the floor of her jail cell and eat with her hands. A filing on Donna's behalf also stated that she had been denied showers, essential medication, and allowed only a single phone call to her husband while incarcerated. All right, Michelle, a lot to unwind, but my first question is a two-parter here. First of all, one, are you shocked at all by Donna Adelson's arrest? And I'm guessing no, but I want to hear your thoughts. And then two, knowing what we do know about her, are you at all shocked about her now complaints about her jail conditions?
No, I don't think I'm not shocked at all by any of these developments, because listen, since Charles Adelson was convicted on, I believe, November 6th, they were on the phone together for 35 hours. I mean, what are a mother and son talking about for 35 hours? You're not gabbing about gossip that's happening in South Florida. These two have been in cahoots for a long time. She's the matriarch of the family and he is a mama's boy. Believe it or not, that's how this all came together. And if you do a lot of digging, which, you know, I'm a journalist, this is what I like to do. She was actually a contestant on Wheel of Fortune many, many moons ago in 1989. And ironically, she did solve a puzzle, and the puzzle that she solved was Mischief Maker. That's Stop ironic it. Because Stop look it. At her today. The fact that she was at Miami airport and got arrested and wanted to get away, she was telling her son what countries did not have extradition. And what she wanted to go to those countries. Why would you go all the way to have these conversations? It's because this woman had a plan. She knew she had to leave the country. And now that she saw that her son was convicted, this was the only thing she had to do. And now that she's been caught, she's making up all this stuff to answer your next question. She's saying that she's not treated well in prison. Well, I know you're 73 years old, but did you expect to be treated in your chateau in South Beach that she's been used to, life that she's been used to? You're in prison. You are going to eat foods that you don't like and be treated in inhumane conditions. You're not supposed to be treated nicely in prison.
Yeah. Yeah, the psychology of these people is just fascinating to me. And this is a horrible, tragic story about the death of a man and a father and everything else over something as silly as a custody dispute. But I'm just, putting aside that horrible aspect of all of it, just looking at it from, if you were watching a movie about this, they're fascinating people in their entitlement, in how they felt that one, this was something they should do, and two, that they thought they could get away with it. I think it's further demonstrated by the idea of what you just brought out, that they're continuing to have these phone conversations. a large part of her trial, I imagine, is going to be the phone conversations that she had with Charlie Adelson. Yet that doesn't prevent her from still hopping on the phone and discussing these plans about leaving the country. And so that's why I asked you the question, because it was just absolutely right up her alley as far as her character. I no surprises that she would start complaining about her conditions in jail.
Well, the entitlement is what it is. I mean, yeah. After she, you know, gets arrested at the airport, you know, she goes to court, she has an outburst. As you know, you guys know, she had an outburst in court, and she said that, you know, these are not livable conditions in jail. And she's just complaining because she's not sorry at the end of the day. She's trying to find an outlet out in some way. And there's no remorse. And I think people saw that in Charles Adelson as well, because Charles Adelson now, who is in prison now, you know, for life, is saying that this is worse than cancer. I mean, these are the types of people they are. They were, I assume, very wealthy people that lived down in South Beach, and they were in a world where they thought that they could get away with anything. And now that this happened, they still, I don't think, get it. They still don't realize, you know, where they are, because they're still having these conversations where they feel they're treated unfair. By the way, the two of them in one of their conversations, I think Charles Adelson complained and said that the verdict came in because these jurors were inbred jurors. Yeah. Like, really? You still don't get it. You still don't get what you did. And so I think they need to be brought back down to earth. And really, I mean, if you're going to live in an inhumane condition in prison, maybe that'll do it.
Yeah, just awful people. Just awful people. I mean, I'm just trying to sit and think. How many conversations do you think they had before the decision was made, let's go ahead and hire someone to kill him? I don't think this was something that happened over one glass of Chardonnay one evening and they said, well, let's go ahead and kill him. These people thought about this and revisited that idea. And like, you know, Mom, remember you were talking about maybe we should do something about it? Were you serious? And you can just imagine how this began to build up. And nowhere along the way is anyone going, okay, this is crazy what we're talking about. We really should not go all the way through with this. Which they did and had to take several steps to do. It just, when you really begin to analyze the psychology of these people, it really starts to shock you. An interesting thing about this to me too, and I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit, is that they waited so long to arrest the mother when it was clear to authorities from the evidence that was presented in court of her involvement. So I don't know why they sat on her for as long as they did. But my next question is, Wendy Adelson, at what point do we not believe that she was either involved or at least had knowledge of this? Or do you think that Mom and son took this whole thing upon themselves and never let her in on it?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. And I go back to the game show because she was also on a game show called The Weakest Link. And that is exactly what Wendy Adelson is in this dynamic. She is the weakest link because she testified. She was put on the stand and there were some holes where she felt the heat because I think, you know, she knew in general, she had to know in general, Josh, that her mother and her brother were up to something because they all did this because of her. This was her husband that was murdered. So the mother has always called herself a domestic coordinator. She runs the show. And when the mother says, this is what you need to do, you need to move from Tallahassee down to South Florida and find a way to do it. Come on. If that was the route and you're telling me she knew nothing about it, she knew something about it. And you're right. I think Wendy Adelson, they may be, I mean, I'm speculating, they may be looking, you know, for the right moment now to get her in as well.
Yeah. I would have said, if it wasn't for the way that they handled things with the mom, I would have said no. If they were going to charge her, they would have done it by now. But the fact that they waited so long on the mom makes me think that Wendy might not be out of the woods. There might be more evidence out there, and they're, for whatever reason, again, delaying any attempt to indict her. But I agree with you. You're taking your grandchildren's father off of this earth. And the mother is not going to be involved or made aware of that, of your intentions to do with that. I mean, I imagine some conversation where they go, hey, if we took care of that problem, would you have any issue with that? And her saying, no, not at all. You know, sip on the Chardonnay again. It's just all so diabolical to me. Fascinating, and it never seems to end, and it's an ongoing saga that will continue to follow, and it sounds like it's going to be something that's going to be making headlines for quite some time with her trial coming up.
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
Then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
Join us 3 times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's dissecting the latest trends or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are going to move to Muskegon, Michigan, where a son's disturbing testimony against his mother revealed an alleged pattern of abuse which resulted in the death of his younger brother. Shonda Vander Ark faces charges of murder and child abuse and the death of the 15-year-old Timothy Ferguson after the boy was found dead in the family's basement. Paul Ferguson, who is also charged in Timothy's death, testified that Vander Ark recruited him in the systematic torture of the teen. Timothy, who had special needs, was allegedly starved for long periods of time, with bread soaked in hot sauce being the boy's only form of sustenance. The child was also forced to sleep in a closet, among other torturous punishments, including ice baths, which allegedly caused Timothy's hypothermic death. Vander Ark, who took the stand in her own defense, reportedly threw up on the witness stand after she was shown a photo of her son's corpse. The mother testified that she didn't remember many of the incidents surrounding Timothy's death, claiming that PTSD had affected her memory. Reportedly, Vander Ark had a history with Child Protective Services prior to Timothy's death. However, she was never stripped of her parental rights. The trial is proceeding rapidly with a verdict likely by the time you're listening to this podcast. And in fact, I watched some of it this morning, and both sides have now rested. The last piece of evidence presented by the prosecution in rebuttal is videotape from inside of the home, which shows the last moments of this young man's life, and the 18-minute delay from when Vander Ark discovers him dead and when she actually calls 911. One other interesting wrinkle is that this was all done, the proceedings today, without her present, because she said that she had a medical condition and did not show up to court waiving her appearance. So lots of twists and turns in this case, and a few surprise ones right towards the end. Michelle, this stuff absolutely turns my stomach. My first question is one that I get asked often in cases about, should the defendant testify? Here you have a defendant testifying on her own behalf. Do you think she did herself any favors in this case?
I don't think that she needed to testify in this case. I mean, I know there are other cases, as you mentioned, that maybe someone has to testify. I know lawyers don't like their clients to testify in these instances, but it doesn't matter, I think, in this case, because I think she is being painted as a monster. She is a monster. I mean, you see the video of the small room that Timothy was put in. I mean, inhumane. You want to talk about inhumane conditions. I mean, you, first of all, don't treat a human being like that. You don't treat your son like that. She says he had mental disabilities. Well, that's not how you nurture someone who is your child. And the fact that she wanted to pour hot sauce on his genitals just shows you just what a beast she is. Not even human it's unfathomable what she did to this child. And to put her other son, Paul, up to this. I mean, who knows? I mean, I don't like to judge a book by its cover, but she looks like a member of the Addams family. She just looks very creepy. Maybe, you know, she threatened her son, Paul. I mean, obviously, you know, now Paul is coming out to testify against her to reveal all these disgusting details about what, you know, they did to Timothy. But I just think, however you look at it, this case also reminds me of another recent case where a father went to prison because of similar matters, the Timothy Farriter case, yeah. Where he said he built a cell that was 6x8 and, you know, he needed to be there. There was no food. You know, it had urine all over the place and feces and all that stuff, you know, found guilty, you know, immediately. Same instance here. I don't see how, you know, she's going to get out of this. It didn't matter to me if she testified or not, because the proof was there. This woman is horrific.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you brought up that Timothy Farriter case, because I was thinking a lot about this too. We see these cases every once in a while where a parent is confronted with a child with call it special needs, call it, you know, the dealing with behavioral issues, whatever you want to call it. And you can, as a parent, I'm a parent, you're a parent, you can, to some extent, kind of understand the difficulties of parenting and how frustrating it can be, and how, especially if you have a child with behavioral issues now, how even further frustrating that might be. But where both of these cases, I think, slipped into the territory of criminal is these kind of elements of torture that were involved. And in the Farriter case, locking this kid in a room and not allowing him to have air conditioning. I mean, it's like, what does that have to do with the difficulty of parenting, the not allowing the air conditioning? And in this case, so many examples of this with the hot sauce and the refusing to feed him and the ice baths and everything else. But even today, there was an officer testified about how at one point, while her son is laying on the floor, she brings in her dog and has her dog lick his face to clean him up and further humiliate him. That's humiliation. That's torture. That has nothing to do with difficult parenting. And I think that is why, you're right, her testifying or not, I don't think would have changed things. The defense has gone with either the strategy of blaming it on the other son or blaming it on her PTSD, inability to remember. Do you think either one of those are going to do anything with this jury?
No, I don't, because I think, you know, she went on the stand. She said, I was a complete failure. Well, you know, as you mentioned, parents are frustrated all the time. We're both parents. You know, I say that I'm a complete failure because today, true story, I forgot my kid's water bottle in their book bag. And I thought, oh my gosh,
how dare you?
He's not going to drink. He's going to die of thirst today. You know, obviously the school, there's water. And this is what I'm thinking, how horrific is I'm a complete failure. But for you to say I'm a complete failure and do all the things that you had just mentioned. And by the way, when I say starvation, it's not like, I had a Thanksgiving feast and I'm going to starve myself for a few hours and not eat something. Starvation for this boy, Timothy, is he was down to 60 something pounds for a 15 year old. How could you even look at him and live with yourself as a mother and say that this is just okay? It is cruel and it is absolutely malicious. And I think, you know, like you said, and I said, it didn't matter if she took the stand or not, because in this case, we have the facts and the facts will tell the story that this person tortured her son.
Yeah. Yeah. And tortured here's a boy, and I'm trying to figure out how to say this right, whose only person in the world that he has to protect him and watch out for him and care for him is the person whose hands he's suffering at, is the person who's torturing him, is the person who's causing him this humiliation and harm and eventual death. And I think that amongst everything else, is what's just going to jurors start to see this sort of stuff. And I've seen this happen in trials, and eventually all of them are just sitting back with their hands folded because they don't need to hear anymore after what they've already heard about this. And like I said, they've closed their evidence today. Closing arguments are expected perhaps this afternoon, and I wouldn't be surprised if we get a very quick verdict out of this. So we will continue to watch that and update everyone. Finally, we move to Clayton County, Georgia, where a vigilante motorist has been convicted on all counts after chasing down and shooting an elderly man who fled from the scene of an auto accident. Hannah Payne faced several counts, including malice murder, aggravated assault, and false imprisonment for the death of Kenneth Herring, who was gunned down in his vehicle just outside of Atlanta. Herring reportedly collided with a tractor trailer and fled the scene before Payne, who was not involved in the crash, chased down Herring, eventually cutting off his vehicle. After blocking the 62-year-old's exit on a busy motorway, Payne screamed at Herring and punched him through his driver's side window. She then produced a 9mm handgun from her hip holster, threatening to shoot Herring twice before immediately, quote unquote, doing so, according to witnesses. Payne took the stand in her own defense, claiming she never intended to kill the man and alleging Herring had shot himself as the two struggle over the firearm. This argument was ultimately unsuccessful, with jurors who convicted Payne after around 90 minutes of deliberation. Payne was highly emotional during the verdict, breaking down in tears after she was found guilty on all counts. And we have some footage of that we're going to show to you now.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty. With regard to count two, as to the offense of felony murder, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty. With regard to count three, as to the offense of aggravated assault, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty. With regard to count four, as the offense of felony murder, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty.
So obviously a pretty emotional reaction from her on this. Michelle Payne spoke with 911 as she was in pursuit of Herring immediately after the accident, and dispatchers repeatedly told her not to follow the man. Was this to you the evidence that was just too much for the defense? Was this is what sealed the deal?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there were a lot of witnesses that saw what happened as well. And all of these witnesses and the videos talked about and seen do not match up with what her story was when she testified. And I think, you know, once again, the jurors could see what was going on. Here she was, a 25-year-old white woman who had no business to really stop the car, block the car of a man, of an incident she wasn't involved in to begin with, comes out, she had a gun in possession, and people saw her go through this road rage. And, you know, road rage is a premeditated act, Josh, you know this. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think she showed any remorse. And, you know, remorse is a significant thing in criminal law as well. You know this as well, because, you know, if you don't show any remorse, your sentence may be heavier. I know that her sentencing is happening, you know, as we speak right now, but I don't expect it to be a light sentence, because this was a person who was told by 911 not to do anything. But here she was, shown in a video that you could see that there was a gun, there was a struggle. And this was a 62-year-old man, Josh. He did not look threatening at all. In fact, apparently he was possibly going through a diabetic shock. So he was not posing any threat to her. She was just not minding her own business in this case. Yeah. I don't know what set her off, but something obviously set her off to do this. And what I didn't like about her and her whole team in the beginning in court was that I don't think they showed any remorse. In fact, those 911 calls that you had mentioned and one of the witnesses that was on the stand, you know, talking about it, they tried to pin the 911 a person and say, oh, well, you didn't give her the right instructions. This is why she did what she did. Are you kidding me? The dispatcher was very calm. I'll give you that. I saw the testimony, the full testimony of the 911 dispatcher. The 911 dispatcher said, we told her exactly what to do. You can hear it. We told her that she needs to be safe. Josh, how is it safe for a citizen? Let's say you were driving, you were involved in an accident, for me to stop, turn around, stop my car, come out. Who knows what, who knows if you have a weapon or not? I have a weapon. I come out, guns a blazing, literally. And, how is that safe for me? So this is a case where she really put her nose in the wrong place. And now she's paying for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. You make an excellent point about the idea of remorse. This is a case that lends itself to the defense showing a tremendous amount of remorse. I mean, I can't see it being anything but a winning strategy for the defense to say, I am so sorry this happened. I never intended for this to happen. This is awful, but I'm not guilty of a crime because X, Y, and Z. And go to whatever arguments you have, but you have to embrace that element of tragedy to begin with. And the fact that they did it, and even kind of in their demeanor in court, I think did them no favors, obviously, with the jury. It seems so simple to point this out, but I don't think anyone is convicting this woman because she tried to intervene. Yes, she's being a busybody, and yes, she's trying to stop somebody from fleeing from an accident and all of that. I think there's, even an argument to be made. Hey, she's just trying to be an upright citizen and everything else. But it's the introduction of the weapon, right? It's the bringing the deadly weapon into this whole mix that didn't need to happen, because had she not done that, both of these people would have walked away alive. And my question, if I can get to it, is that do you think because of that weapon, and I know that that's what caused the death, and it's like I said, this is kind of a simple thing to point out, but do you think that's why in sentencing a judge is going to try to make an example to say, hey, this is something I want to make sure everyone watching this and observing understands is not acceptable?
Yeah, I mean, I think the weapon did it. We saw the video of it. We saw it happen. It went off, and a person doesn't have a life anymore, And I think, I've been watching some of the victim impact statements, that has been happening. The family said, we want to see her with the maximum sentence because we got the maximum sentence watching our loved one now forever be gone. And so that to me hit me.
Well, Michelle, we don't have this happen often. So it is interesting that we're allowed to update our listeners as we're recording this. We found out that there is, in fact, a sentence in this case, and it lends itself towards the arguments we were just making. She's going to receive life with the possibility of parole, but plus an additional 13 years for the false imprisonment and the weapons charges. So what that means in an actual calculation of how much time she will serve is something that the time will tell. But what this signals to me is that sounds like the maximum the judge could give. This to me does not sound like a verdict that thought that some sort of mercy was necessary. She's going to spend the better part of her life, if not her life, behind bars after this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised by this because, look, we have murder, malice, aggravated assault, and weapon possession. These are a plethora of things we're talking about here that should not be taken lightly. She should pay for it. As the saying goes, if you do the crime, you got to pay the time. And I think, they did it right. And I think the family, obviously, families are never going to, get their loved ones back, but this is some small victory for them, a bit of a relief to see that there is a little bit of justice now for them.
Yeah, and again, just so senseless, because now she's going to spend the rest of her life behind bars too. A, 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 um, a thing that she didn't start that day believing would happen to her. And for this stupid reaction and carrying around a weapon and using it in an incredibly reckless way, now a man has lost her life and she's going to essentially be behind bars for the rest of her life. Well,
she's a lunatic that, you know, now has a lot of time to think about what she did, that split moment that she did that is now going to cost her entire life.
Yeah. And I agree with you, too, that I think this was a message needed to be sent by the judge. I mean, part of sentencing has to do with punishment and protecting the community, but also saying, where does our society stand on some of these issues? And I think this is a clear message being sent. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on this week. I really appreciated hearing all of your thoughts. Where can people find out more about you?
Well, I'm on social media. You could check out the handle Michelle UTV on X, which is formerly Twitter, and of course, Instagram as well. I also cover still a lot of sports in the tennis world. So if you're interested in that, just follow my stuff on Instagram.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me on, Josh.
Absolutely. And I will follow those tennis updates on Instagram. And I'm your host, Josh Ritter. You can find me on Instagram and X, or formerly Twitter, at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. You can find our sidebar episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments you'd like us to address, tweet us your questions with the hashtag TCD Sidebar. And thank you for joining us at the True Crime Daily Sidebar.